Get a jump start on 2024 in a new Kia from Robert Brogdon's Olathe Kia. Shop their large selection, including the new Sorento, Niro, and Soul models. You'll score big with low prices, trade assist cash, and a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit olathekia.com.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Sporting Kansas City Show right here on your home for SKC Soccer, Sports Radio 810 WHB. And of course, if you're not listening to us live on the radio, we appreciate you listening to the podcast on the 810 app at 810WHB.com or Spotify, iTunes, anywhere you can get your podcasts. We, of course, appreciate you subscribing, liking, and downloading the show. My name is Nate Bucati, and I am joined, as always, by the one and only Carter Augustine. What's up, Carter? How are you, man?
What's up, Nate? Doing great. How are you?
I don't know what to do with my hands right now because all of a sudden there's been like seven games in a really short period of time, and all of a sudden we got no game.
International break.
Weekend.
Well, there is a Swope Park Rangers game.
I like the way that you leaned into the microphone and lowered your voice. That was like Barry White type stuff right there. You've got your Swope Park Rangers hoodie on, and you are the voice of the Rangers. So you got your home opener.
So they're in the Eastern Conference this year, which is really interesting, intriguing. Got the Pittsburgh Riverhounds coming to town on Saturday at 4 p.m. So looking forward to that. But you're right. It's been breakneck speed to start the season for Sporting Kansas City. It feels like, I'm tired. I don't know about the players, but it's been hectic.
Yeah, and I will say that I'm excited about the Swope Park Rangers season two, partially because I get the opportunity to call a few games that you will be unavailable for, and so I'm excited about that. But so many young guys that have been added to this team, and they keep signing young players from the academy and calling up players from the academy to play in these games. You get a real glimpse of players that are already on the Sporting Kansas City roster in some cases and other guys that might be in the very near future. So I think the first couple years we saw a little bit of that, but I think it's growing, and there are more young, exciting, upcoming players that you can watch.
Yeah, they seem to be even more so trying to incorporate academy players into the fold with the Rangers. We saw a concerted effort for that last year with Paolo Nakamura's first year, and I think you're right. It seems like this year it might even be more. And then, you know, could we see perhaps Gideon Zalalem getting some time there? Who knows? That's certainly what the team is there for, to try and help incorporate some players in. Would have liked to maybe see Guatu Baye, but he's away on international duty as well, so that won't happen this weekend. But, I'm with you. I think it's going to be a really exciting season for the Rangers.
Yeah, and to go back to your point, I'm tired too. It's just been – and not in a bad way. I don't think anybody wants to hear us complain about getting to watch a bunch of awesome soccer games and travel to cool places. It's just a fact that you get back, and today I have not been as productive today as I had set out in my mind, because you end up, you know, you're just kind of in a bit of a daze. And I think it just illustrates that the players need this. They need this week, and they're getting a couple of days to rest and recover, because April's going to be crazy as well, since the team has advanced to the semifinals of the Champions League. And we'll start with some news there before we go back to recapping the game against the Colorado Rapids, the 1-1 draw in Commerce City. And also, I'll lay out the menu for you. Coming up on the show, we are going to visit with a couple of national soccer pundits, I guess you could call it, because we want to talk Sporting, MLS, Champions League, but also the international window. The United States men's national team, to me, is finally getting to the point where it's worth sitting up and watching again and paying attention to, in their game on Thursday night. And so we're going to talk with Taylor Twellman, who will be on the call of that game, but also obviously covers MLS like crazy for ESPN. So we can cover all of those things with Taylor Twellman in the next segment. Then Paul Carr, who's actually a Kansas native, had worked for ESPN for a long time, now has some other ventures going on that we could talk to him about, but he's always tweeting out really interesting factoids about MLS games and United States men's national team stuff. So we'll talk to him as well. But the news that came out today, Carter, we finally have the dates for this series against Monterrey. It will be Sporting Kansas City heading down to Monterrey, Mexico on April 4th. That game will kick off at 9 p.m. Central Time, which is late because that's local time down there too, I believe. And then the return, that's a Thursday, by the way, April 4th. And then the return leg will be Thursday, April 11th at Children's Mercy Park, 8 p.m. Central Time. Get your tickets at SeatGeek.com. Go to SportingKC.com. You can get all the details there and get tickets as well. But we have the dates now, so we can start to really focus and ramp up for that.
Yeah, Thursday to Thursday. You know, I like the Thursday return leg for sure. I think that is a good day for everyone to get out. You know, maybe a little late to work on Friday action, if you can spin that. But and this series is going to be so fun. Just two cathedrals, really, in soccer in North America that will be perfect settings for the two games. And I'm hoping that some people can get down to Mexico as well. I know I'm excited. I hope we can go down there, and it's just it's going to be a fantastic series. And you're right, finally got the dates, so it's starting to move along here.
Yeah, that stadium looks incredible. So what we're going to have coming up for Sporting, they play on Saturday, March 30th, at home against Montreal. Then that Thursday they'll go down to Monterrey, then come back to the United States on Sunday, April 7th, to play at FC Cincinnati. Their atmosphere looks incredible in their first year. Then the Thursday game at home, and then a Sunday game on April 14th at home against the Red Bulls. So four games in a short period of time again, as soon as basically March 30th rolls around, coming up for Sporting KC. So they're going to rest up and get ready for that. All right, let's talk about this this last match for Sporting. 1-1 at the Colorado Rapids. What did you take away from it, Carter? You were on the sideline.
I took away that Johnny Russell's pretty good.
Breaking news.
Yeah, breaking news. I mean, he was such a difference maker when he came on. We heard Peter Vermes at halftime talking about how he just didn't think guys were really aggressive in the first half or taking spaces that were there, running at people. They had a lot of ball in the first half, didn't really create a whole lot. And you see the difference that a guy like Johnny Russell makes when he comes off the bench and just immediately, I think he got the ball within a minute and earned a corner or something. He's going down the right wing. So he comes on. He's a game changer. And to curl in that equalizer, fantastic. I can't believe that was the first free kick goal for Sporting since 2015.
Well, Graham Zusi's taken a lot of paint out of the woodwork over that stretch of time.
Yeah, he smashed the woodwork a few times.
And he got denied by a terrific save on a free kick in the Independiente game as well. And I sure thought Tim Howard could have got there. And I don't want to say that because I don't want to take credit away from what a great strike it was by Johnny Russell, but he was on that side of the goal, and he just kind of gave up on the play, it seemed. I don't know if he didn't see it or what.
Yeah, that I'm with you. That was kind of strange. It felt like he was near enough to it to make a more of an effort. I don't know if he just doesn't have the same power, you know, trying to power off his left leg there, going to his left as he might.
40-year-old legs don't have the explosion. I can say that from experience.
Honestly, that might have been a factor. Or maybe he just didn't see it in time. It was a well-taken strike, obviously. But, it was a strange – just looking at the replays, he seemed a lot closer than a guy who's not going to even sprawl out for that one would be.
And, of course, I Sporting are able to grab a point out of it with several players that are suffering minor injuries at this time. And as we said, 6 games in 18 days, sometimes you just got to grind through and get a result out of it. Had they not made a mistake, which was a very uncharacteristic mistake earlier in the game, maybe they get all 3 points. Who knows how the rest of that game plays out. They did make the mistake, but I thought it was interesting when you talked to Peter Vermes afterwards, seemed like he was pretty ready to just write that off. Yeah. Look, mistakes happen sometimes. The way we play, I'm not going to sweat it too much. What did you think of his response?
That's what it seemed like, right? Because it's their MO to play quickly out of the back and play it short and try and pass it along the back line, and they've done it so well. And, you know, also talking to him at halftime and him saying that, you know, he might have been a little surprised at how the Rapids weren't really pressing. They're opportunistic at times, but really they sat off them, and I think we'll see that a lot because Sporting is so good at playing it around the back. The times that we've seen Toluca try and press, other teams try and press, Sporting can really pass it around that press and through the press, and they've created some of their best attacking moments when teams try and come high on them. So I would expect maybe that's a theme that we'll see from opposition in MLS the rest of the year, even more so than in the past, is, you know, try and break down this deep block. Even if Colorado's the home team, I think we'll see that. But yeah, I'm with you. It doesn't really seem like he would want to change playing it out of the back just because of one little mistake that was made back there. So other than that, I didn't think Colorado caused them many problems.
No, they didn't break down Sporting Kansas City really much, if at all. Maybe a couple times in the first 5 minutes of the game or so, they had a couple of half chances. But like you said, I didn't feel like they looked like scoring all night. Credit to Diego Rubio. He anticipated it. He knew the way Sporting KC want to play, and maybe that's part of what led to it. Do we care that he celebrated against his former team?
I don't personally, especially because he got traded.
Right.
And that's a nuance of it that I don't know if a lot of people have discussed. I've seen this has popped up a lot in the national media. It's a fun topic. Rubio talked last week about the law of the X's. It always seems like in soccer you're going to score against your former team.
Mm-hmm.
And he got traded away. So for me, you know, it's not like he played 250 games at Sporting Kansas City and, you know, was an absolute legend at the club or something. In that case, you might expect it from the player just because that's what they feel. And, you know, it's not because of the outside pressure. I personally don't have a feeling. I don't have a problem. What about you?
Didn't bother me at all. To me, like, it bothers me that you give up the goal. You know, I think if Sporting are angry at anything, maybe that he wasted a little bit of time.
That might be I think a couple players had words with him at the center circle just because maybe of how long the celebration took. And he was walking back from the corner a lot slower than the other Colorado players. So maybe that's where he crossed the line for some of his former teammates. I don't know.
They just wanted to get on with the game and, you know, get back to it. Diego Rubio has a lot of things that he does through the course of the game that get under the skin of their opponent. I think that we saw that in Kansas City. One of the things you kind of like about him when he's on your team, he's going to nip at the back of your heels. He's going to run through the back of your legs after, you know, you've already passed the ball away. He's going to try to buy a couple of penalties that maybe, you know, aren't there. And I think those things maybe bother the players a little bit more than I could be wrong. Maybe the players feel different than me. But I go back to what you said is, like, the national media seemed to try to make something of it. So a lot of stuff from MLS soccer and things like that saying, oh, he celebrated against his former team. For me, it is a complete difference when if you choose to leave somewhere and then you come back to a team that where the fans supported you and all those things, you disrespect them, especially maybe on their home field and their home stadium. You get sent away by the team. They trade you away. I can understand a player wanting to prove to them, hey, you know, look what you're missing out on. You know, you sent me away. And I don't, if anything, I would want a player to have a chip on his shoulder. You know, that's being a competitor. So, and I really, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm not looking in the right places. I haven't seen any outrage from any Sporting KC fans about it.
Yeah, it doesn't
at all.
I haven't really seen that either. And maybe that's because, you know, like I said, it's not like he is in the record books here. But even if,
but I think they all know he was traded away.
Yeah, he was. And even if, say, like a Davey Arnaud comes back and scores, and I wouldn't have expected him to celebrate just because of the guy he is. But imagine scoring an 89th minute winner for your new team. You know, why wouldn't you want a guy to celebrate that? You know, he's playing for this new team. He has teammates, and you know, that's just soccer. You know, it's a business a lot of the times, and these are guys that they're humans. Yeah. So I've never really had a problem with it. And honestly, some of my favorite moments have come from it, like Adebayor sprinting down the length of the pitch against Arsenal is one of the funniest things you'll ever see on a soccer field.
As an Arsenal fan, I didn't enjoy that one as much. I thought that was a little more brazen, personally.
It was a little more brazen, sprinting the length of the field.
Yeah. But, you know, and I don't mean any disrespect to Diego Rubio. He had some fantastic moments with Sporting KC, but he's not going up on the wall of honor.
Yeah.
At Children's Mercy Park, we're not talking to me. Like, it's one thing if a real legend at your club has left at the end of his career and then kind of rubs your nose in it after he's gone. I didn't take what happened there to be that way.
Yeah.
It was a guy who had a brief time in Kansas City, got traded away. Probably happy he scored against the team he traded away from and got his first goal with his new team. And I think we move on from there, and I don't think we need to really talk about that anymore. So there we go. We'll take a break. When we come back, we will talk with Taylor Twellman about CONCACAF Champions League, about U.S. men's national team action coming up on Thursday, and more on the Sporting Kansas City Show. The Sporting Kansas City Show continues here on your home for SKC Soccer, Sports Radio 810 WHB. And, of course, if you're listening live, we appreciate that. If you're listening on the podcast page at 810WHB.com or on Spotify or on iTunes. We appreciate that as well. Make sure you subscribe and listen to the podcast if you don't have a chance to catch us live over the air as well. And we've got a lot to talk about, even though it's an upcoming off weekend for Sporting Kansas City. We've got a lot to talk about with SKC, and we've got the international break to talk about. So who better to break all of this down with us than Taylor Twellman, our good buddy from ESPN. Taylor, how you doing, man? Thanks for joining us.
Good, Nate. You might be the only person in Kansas City that calls me your good buddy, so I'll take it.
Hey, look, man, you know, we take our friends wherever we can find them. let's jump in. If you don't mind, I'd like to jump in on some CONCACAF talk with you first.
Yeah, of course.
We here in Kansas City are pretty fired up about, you know, making it to the semifinals for the first time, at least in this iteration of the competition in franchise history, and being the only MLS team left. I know you've talked a lot about the challenges for MLS teams in this competition. What do you make just in general of the league's showing or lack thereof, I guess, in this year's competition?
It's an interesting conversation, Nate. You know, when you think of Major League Soccer and its growth over the last, I'd say, 3 to 5 years, many of us felt that was 10, 15 years down the road. And after Monterrey played Atlanta United in like one, we did like a two-minute, 45-second, three-minute piece for SportsCenter, because the topic of conversation that's been consistent is, why does Major League Soccer struggle in CONCACAF Champions League? And there's going to be one-offs, Nate. You're going to see Toronto like they did in 2018 with a phenomenal run, arguably one of the best runs ever if they had won it with Tigres and the teams they beat along the way. But Ajax just beat Real Madrid in Champions League. That doesn't necessarily mean that the Dutch league's better than La Liga. So you're going to have one-offs. The problem for MLS is this, is that there's two things that really hurt MLS trying to compete in this competition. First and foremost, the schedule. Peter Vermees, the coach and manager and technical director of Sporting Kansas City, Nate, he actually approached the MLS Players Union about this six-week break that is mandatory in the CBA of trying to get them to be a little, you know, I'd say easy on the Sporting Kansas City players, and credit to the Illich family and the ownership group that they went out and did hyperbaric oxygen chambers and all that story that went on. But the reality is this, when Monterrey played Atlanta, for example, they played 10 competitive games before they played them leg one. So no matter what, this is the analogy I used on Sports Center. That's like running a 100-yard dash and telling your competition you get a 15 to 20-yard head start.
Mm-hmm.
The second one, Nate, and more importantly, is MLS is trying to win an open market competition while playing in a roster rules and regulations a closed market. So Atlanta, and I'm using Atlanta Monterrey because it's just much easier for the people to compare. Monterrey's roster salary budget is 2.91 times what Atlanta United is if you take the transfer fees out of the window. If you put transfer fees into the window, it's actually just a little less, but that's because of the PD Martinez. So my whole point is this, is while Sporting Kansas City, Atlanta United, and all of these teams are trying to win a competition where no one else has any rules and the schedule suits them of being fitter, when that game, that competition comes around, it's always going to be difficult for MLS teams.
So there's a couple different things I want to explore from what you just said, and I guess we'll start with this. You know, one of the challenges for the MLS teams, too, is with those roster limitations, they've got to try to compete in this competition and then still stay, you know, relevant in their league. And, you know, Sporting just got done with a stretch of 6 games in 18 days. A lot of people point to Toronto's run last year as what maybe torpedoed their regular season. I look on the flip side and say, well, the Red Bulls made it to the semis last year, and they went on to put up 70 points in a season. How does Sporting Kansas City manage this? Do you think they're capable of managing these competitions on multiple fronts right now?
I actually do believe they're capable of doing something similar. I'm not going to predict right now that Sporting Kansas City is going to win the Supporter Shield. However, I do think they're going to have a say in it. I just think Vermees and company built a very talented roster, deeper roster than he has in years past. I mean, look at Kellen Rowe's pickup, Rodney Wallace. You look at these kind of MLS veterans that are very capable of being in your 11 week in and week out if you need them. And those are your depth players. right, at this present time. So it works. Now, the question will be, who's your number nine if Namath goes down, right? So you have those questions. But to answer your question, I do think Sporting Kansas City may be the one off there. But it's very difficult to build a roster of 22 players. And I say 22 because that's what the good teams in the region do. It's not a top seven heavy roster, and then you have that huge trip. And for the listeners at home, look at your Sporting Kansas City team and try to compare it versus Monterey. If you took three players out of Sporting Kansas City starting 11 and allowed Sporting Kansas City to go spend $500,000 per player, so $1.5 million salary, on those said three players, now you've got three starters end up becoming your depth players. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
That's the difference between Liga MX and MLS. It's just they're deeper. I mean, Liga MX league game between Tigres and Monterrey, there were 16 internationals on the field. 16.
Yeah. I mean, there's no doubt when you talk about the salary discrepancy from Atlanta to Monterrey, it's going to be even more exaggerated when Sporting take on Monterrey. So maybe for our listeners, how much of an uphill battle is this going to be for Sporting Kansas City? What kind of a chance do you give them in this semifinal leg?
I give them a chance because Peter Vermes' teams have always been able to prepare for their opposition. And we've seen the evolution of Peter Vermes and Sporting Kansas City. Nate, you know better than me, but over the last two or three years, now they can play possession if they need to. They can also still defend. You know, this is a team that can still defend. I think they're a little bit more proactive than years past in getting forward. They've got a very good chance. Obviously, when you play Liga MX teams in this competition, you have to take care of business at home to give yourself an opportunity to steal a result on the road. And that's the most important thing from Sporting Kansas City. If you give up one away goal, two away goals, your backs are against the wall. If you post a shutout at home and you steal a goal, but even if you tie the game 0-0 at home, you've got a shot. It's so important that at home they post that shutout and give themselves an opportunity to steal it on the road.
We're visiting with Taylor Twellman from ESPN. And, of course, part of the reason we wanted to talk to you right now, Taylor, is it's the international window now. And for some Sporting KC players, that means a much-needed rest. Other guys like Christian Namath, Botan Barat, and Johnny Russell will be going to join their national teams. But we also get to see more of Greg Berhalter's vision for the United States men's national team. So before I talk about some specific news that he's put out there leading up to this game on Thursday that you guys will have on ESPN2, I'd just like to get your general thoughts. Have you noticed any big differences so far? What's maybe your biggest takeaway of the early picture that we've gotten from Greg Berhalter as the head coach?
Well, I think there's going to be some growing pains, and he doesn't have enough time. You know, you have the Gold Cup coming up immediately. These are your last two full international friendlies before that Gold Cup comes up. So all those European-based players, Pulisic, McKennie, Adams, this is really the, you know, John Brooks, Matt Miazga, the only time you're going to get these guys before those pre-Gold Cup games. So, you know, the conversation of what's his right back going to look like, where is Michael Bradley's role, who's his number nine, I think those still remain. And that's like the Ecuador game Thursday night in ESPN2 and the Chile game the following Tuesday in ESPN2. I think these two friendlies are massive in trying to see what he wants to do. It's going to be interesting. I think the Greg Berhalter of Columbus Crew is going to be a little different with the U.S. men's national team, because I think at the international level, there still needs to be a conscious effort that you need to be solid defensively, you need to high press, you need to make teams uncomfortable, which is what, you know, the United States did so well for so long at the international level. And while all of us, Nate, want a proactive style, you also need to be realistic. And I think there needs to be a balance, and I think you're going to see a different evolution of Greg Berhalter. But keep in mind, he's the only coaching and managing he's done. Nate, it's been day in and day out with the same players. So he's going to have some growing pains in trying to figure out who he is and what it takes, because the last game was when? Early February, and we haven't seen him since. This is all new for Greg Berhalter as it is for the entire program.
And that's exactly what I want to get your perspective on as a former player, maybe specifically, because, you know, I felt like during the Jurgen Klinsmann era, I didn't feel like there was ever an identity. The team did never seem to have an idea of this is how we play, this is what we're going to hang our hat on. And being around Peter Vermes a lot, that's one thing you never wonder about in Kansas City. Every single guy on the team knows his job, knows how we're going to play. It might not always work, but everybody knows exactly what the responsibilities are. And my limited time around Greg Berhalter has told me that that's his attitude as well. We have a system. Everybody knows their job. But I've had some people in the world of soccer tell me, look, that stuff's overblown at the international level because of what you just said, that you don't have that much time with these guys. You got a couple of weeks to get them in training together before you got to go out and play a game. So some of that stuff's overstated. Where do you come down on the importance of him giving a clear identity to this team going forward?
No, you can have, first off, everyone saying that there's no identity with Jurgen Klinsmann. There was an identity. It's just I'm not sure anyone could really figure it out. But that in itself is an identity. I mean, Nate, and it's not, you know, Jurgen came in, and like every new manager at any club or any national team around the world, said, we're going to be proactive, we're going to have possession. And then you watch the United States play, and it was the exact opposite. But they did get results. You know, that's the one thing that people kind of forget is, they got results. Their backs were against the wall in the first regime. Now, the second part of Jurgen Klinsmann's time, and even with Bruce Arena, that was where, you know, everything hit the fan. It's very difficult to have a Sporting Kansas City, since we're on this radio show and podcast, but I'm going to use a different example, a Liverpool type of identity at the international level. You can't do it. It's impossible to bring in all these players from different clubs that are working with their managers at those said clubs every single day for, what, 4 days before the United States plays Ecuador on Thursday? Hey, that's very difficult to be so nuanced and so in tune. Now, in saying that, the Peter Vermes, the Greg Berhalters, the Jesse Marshes of the world, your team's going to be very prepared. There's not going to be a single player going into the game not knowing what their role is. And that's what you're asking me. Mm-hmm. Versus the Jurgen Klinsmann time. That's where the players in the locker room, they've said it. You don't need someone on the outside like you and I to say it. Those players on the inside, they've all said it. Under Jurgen, we didn't really know. They'll know under Greg, it's just whether or not it works or not. It's an apples to oranges conversation of having an identity at the club level versus an identity at the national team level. And too often fans, especially on social media, they mix and get confused because they've had no experience in trying to do it, or they don't understand how to assess that. France won the World Cup playing what way? Just a simple counterattacking style because that's how it worked for them. Do you think that amount of talent, if Didier Deschamps had them, that's how they would play every day? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. But that's how it works because he's bringing in all those different players for what, 4, 10, 12 days?
Right. We're visiting with Taylor Twellman once again, and you briefly touched on the news that's kind of got everybody talking right now, which is, look, Tyler Adams is becoming one of the new great young stars that people are excited about on the national team level, and he's doing it in central midfield in Germany, and that's what he did with the Red Bulls. But the news coming out that Greg Berhalter might look at him as a right back in this camp and push DeAndre Yedlin up the field. What do you make of this news?
Well, the toilet bowl that is of Twitter all told me I was an idiot when I brought up Tyler Adams at the international level playing late back in 2017 and 2018. And the big reason why I brought it up, I'm not going to take credit, but he's just listening to Jim assessing his young Tyler Adams and also forecasting how that fit into the national team. Now, I didn't know Greg Berhalter was going to be the national team coach, but the moment you saw Nick Lima play right back in January, you knew the answer to that was Tyler Adams. He wants his right back, in particular, to be a wing back slash center midfielder. And so Tyler Adams becomes that, very similar to what Pep Guardiola does with his wing backs at Man City. And so Tyler Adams fits that. Now, it's a little interesting because technically in Germany, Weston McKennie's playing right back or right wing, and Tyler Adams is playing in the middle. So why not just make that the switch?
Mm-hmm.
That's what Greg Berhalter wants to do in these two friendlies coming up. And I think a big part of it is because he wants Michael Bradley on the field, and also he wants to have Christian Pulisic play centrally. So it's going to be interesting. I do think, and I've said this all along, The moment Greg Berhalter became manager, I said, there's going to be two players that are on the cusp of being out of the team. And I said, DeAndre Yedlin is one and John Brooks being the other. DeAndre Yedlin has played right back for a team that defends first, that looks for the counter, and everyone having this comparison. Well, in 2014 World Cup, he played as a right winger. One, that was 5 years ago. Two, that was the introduction of DeAndre Yedlin at the international level, and it was the only way he was going to have any impact at the World Cup. I've watched DeAndre Yedlin enough. Nate, so have you. Is he technical enough to be a right winger in the attack? I'm not sure about that. And so I think it's going to be very interesting to see what role DeAndre Yedlin plays, because you are talking about a regular starter for a mid-table team in the English Premier League may not be suited for the U.S. men's national team, and that's a big talking point.
Well, and you just mentioned the other guy that's been a hot-button topic for me forever, and that's John Brooks. And full Matt Beisler bias being acknowledged ahead of time here, Taylor, but I always felt like everybody, back when Beisler was playing all the time, looked at Brooks as the young, more upside, you know, more promise, playing in a bigger league, solution at that left center back position. But every time I watched him play, I saw a guy switch off oftentimes in a position where you can't afford to do that. And as opposed to Mr. Reliable Matt Beisler, who to me was kind of taken for granted, I just haven't seen it from John Brooks on a consistent enough basis. What makes you say
me
that
neither.
Maybe he's in trouble with Berhalter?
Me neither, Nate. Me neither. John Brooks, you also got to remember that huge upside was in large part because he sold for $20 million plus, right?
Right.
So naturally, you look at that at that time and say, well, there is an upside here to him. Matt Beisler is 100% Mr. Reliable, but your bias is getting in the way of being realistic about Matt Beisler as well. Matt Beisler, after the World Cup, wasn't very good. And that was the part of that. There was a period there where Matt Beisler didn't have his legs. Remember, when he came into the national team, he had pace, mm-hmm. and it was pace that no one really wanted to talk about, but Matt never really got beat. And so as he's gotten older, that pace is still, I think his positioning's actually improved. And I think Matt's been very good over the last 12 to 14 months, but I do think he was taken for granted. His form wasn't good, and so much of it was looked at John Brooks. But I still say I was in the camp of saying John Brooks. John Brooks right now is Greg Berhalter's bigger project. And it's not the Tyler Adams, DeAndre Yedlin right back. It's John Brooks, because if you've got a Bundesliga starting center back in a position where everyone wants to tell me that it's the deepest position, yet I can't tell you who the two starting center backs are right now in a must-win game. Nobody can. That's disappointing. And that's concerning if you're asking me. If John Brooks is not engaged, it is not fully committed with Greg Berhalter and playing at a high level, then the United States has big concerns, because then you're starting to ask a lot of an Omar Gonzalez coming in, Tim Ream, where you shouldn't be asking a lot of these guys now. And who knows, Matt Beisler may play himself back into the picture. But Greg Berhalter's number one project, in my opinion, is John Brooks and getting the best out of him, because no one else has before him.
Yeah, I'll finish with this, Taylor. You know him a lot better than me. I got to spend a couple of hours around Greg Berhalter when I was fortunate enough to call the Sporting Columbus game for Fox Sports last year. So that's the only time I've spent around him. But my read on him, you tell me, if he's not getting the full commitment from a player, that guy's not going to see the field. I don't get the sense that if John Brooks isn't engaged at all times, you tell me, is Berhalter the kind of guy that's going to put up with that?
No, he's not. I've played with Greg with the national team. We were roommates a couple games. I've known Greg for a very long time. He's not. Now, I think what helps in this instance is Greg was an international center back that played at, went to a couple World Cups, right? So he's going to understand that position better than I am. I mean, I hated center backs. I went up against them. Now, I say that jokingly, Nate, but the reality is center forwards can give you a good read on center backs, too.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's going to put up with it. I don't. I also don't think he's going to put up with if they struggle within a system. I think he's going to adapt. I think he's going to evolve. I think that's the one thing that stood out to me is he has a plan, but he's open. He's very open-minded. And I think that's very welcoming to a lot of the players after the previous you know, two coaches before them. I think there's going to be some of this. But I go back to my first answer, Nate. There's still growing pains. There's not a ton of time here. So it's going to be interesting to see how Greg reacts. But if a player's not committed and a player's not buying in, I don't think he's going to put up with it, no matter where he's playing.
Hey, Taylor, this is great stuff. We could do this for a long time, but I know you got stuff to do. You've got USA versus Ecuador, 7 o'clock on ESPN on Thursday. We'll be watching. We really appreciate the time, and safe travels, man.
Thanks for having me, Nick. Appreciate it.
All right. That is Taylor Twellman, and I'll say it again. He's our good buddy here on the Sporting Kansas City Show back after this. And our thanks to Taylor Twellman for joining us in the last segment here on the Sporting Kansas City Show. This is going to become, I think, a routine thing, but we have time constraints when we're on the radio on Sports Radio 810 WHB, but we don't with the podcast. So we had to clip a little bit of the Taylor Twellman interview out to make sure that it all fits in on the show today. But if you want to listen to the entire interview, especially a lot of his thoughts on the U.S. men's national team, just make sure you listen to the podcast at 810WHB.com or on iTunes or Spotify. And we go from one terrific guest that can talk all soccer things with us to another, and a local guy. He's been national, but he's from here. Paul Carr, who for a long time was with ESPN Stats and Info, and now True Media Sports joins us. Hey, Paul, how are you, man?
Hi, Nate. And if I know your pain, because I could never get Taylor to shut up and stop talking either, so that's always a challenge that I've had to deal with for years.
So how long were you with ESPN?
I spent 10 years at ESPN doing a lot of soccer and a lot of other sports. But soccer was kind of my specialty. Got to do a couple World Cups on site and lots of other big events. So lots of fun, and now moved on to True Media.
And so tell us about True Media, what you do there, and maybe what people should know about it.
Sure. It's a web engineering and sports data analytics company. Like, we basically take all the stats and turn them into easy-to-use websites for sports teams and media to use. So we have, you know, about 40 soccer clubs around the world that use our product, and 20 baseball teams, 10 NFL teams, and media, including, you know, ESPN and Fox and different things. It basically just gives them an easy tool to find stats and analytics and things along those lines.
And I know you're a Kansas native originally. Are you back? Are you back here in this area now?
I am. Yeah, born and raised in Topeka. Just moved back, working from home for True Media. So it's good to be back in the Midwest after a decade out of New England.
Yeah, very good. Paul, I'm just curious. I've been following you for a long time. One of the best stats, especially when it comes to soccer, follows on Twitter, I think. I'm curious, what's the path that took you to being so involved with soccer?
Sure. I'm always a big sports fan. And then my gateway drugs into soccer were the 94 World Cup. And MLS started in 1996. Kind of just followed that and got into it a little bit more all the time. You know, 98 World Cup. Soccer started becoming more accessible on TV in the early to mid-2000s. And just kind of kept growing my love of the sport that way. And then when I went out to ESPN in 08, they didn't have a soccer researcher. I was hired just as a researcher, but quickly kind of filled that soccer niche. We had Euros that summer. Then we had the World Cup in South Africa a couple years later. So just kind of been a slow developing thing for me over the last 20 or so years. The soccer love. I came to it later in life, but it's strong and growing now.
I feel like you must be about the same age as me, Paul, because you just described my arc as a soccer fan too.
There we go.
Yeah, and so I think it's interesting because as I've learned to grow my appreciation and love for the sport, I think we come about these things. You start watching. And you start learning the game a lot of times from the announcers that are watching, and you hear the language that's used, and you start to pick up things from the analysts to kind of break down the game. And then all of a sudden, you start craving a deeper understanding, and I think that's where kind of what you do now comes in, the statistics and all of that. And I got to be honest, it's something I still feel like as a broadcaster, I'm feeling my way through to understand, because it seemed like, back in the day it was, how many corner kicks are there? How many goals? How many assists? And the rest of it, you didn't see that much of in soccer. But you're working in it now. How much is the statistical component of the game evolving, maybe in current time right now?
Yeah, it's big. I mean, so when I started at ESPN in 08, it was still from a ESPN perspective, and I think mostly a U.S. perspective, those basic stats, and that was it. And I remember right before the 2010 World Cup is when we first got access to a lot of the touch-by-touch data, you know, touches and passes and, you know, things that are relatively normal now, but at the time they hadn't used much. And at that World Cup, we were almost kind of overwhelmed. Like, we almost didn't know what to pick out and do things with it. And the more familiarity I got with it, the more I realized, you know, it works a very similar way to these other sports like, you know, baseball that I grew up with and you grew up with that have all the statistics. You're just trying to find different ways to tell the story. So, like you said, you listen to announcers, you hear what they're talking about, and then from my angle, I'm thinking, okay, well, what numbers do we have that might be able to kind of back that up and support that or contradict it or whatever it might be? So it's kind of the same way as in other sports. It's just, you know, soccer is, whatever, 20 or 30 years or maybe way longer behind baseball, and it's a few years behind football and basketball. But I tried to apply just those same principles that I had and had learned growing up kind of in an American sports culture and just pull them over to soccer. Like, find the number and the note that's telling me the story of what's going on in this game.
Have you found much resistance from people within the game to these, you know, newfangled new world stats?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're all familiar with the kind of the stat person versus the scout,
sure,
more or less, as those stereotypes, and those, there's definitely some truth to that in soccer, just like there is in baseball or pretty much any sport. So, yeah, you definitely run into that, or people don't want to hear about, you know, something like expected goals, which is a little bit harder maybe to wrap your head around. But the thing I always come back to, even with people like that, is like, look, you may hate expected goals, but then you say that this team needs to take better shots. And, you know, something like expected goals is measuring shot quality, which is exactly what you're talking about. So I always try to find the common ground with them, you know. Like, we're saying the same thing, or we're describing a player the same way. Ultimately, we're just kind of using a different road to get there. So there is the resistance. I think within teams especially, it's less and less, because teams more data to inform their scouting and player recruitment and whatnot. So it's still there. It's getting less on the team level, and it's still on the media level at some point, but less so probably in the U.S. than other places.
All right, we're talking with Paul Carr, and by the way, if you want some really interesting statistical nuggets and things like that as a soccer fan, you should follow him on Twitter for sure, at Paul Carr, PaulCarr. So two R's at the end of the name there. And let's get into some of these things because, by the way, your pinned tweet I thought was fun because we used it in our broadcast Sporting played Philadelphia, and Marco Fabian became the first player with a straight red card and a missed penalty in the same MLS game since 2013. I'm kind of curious, like, did you have to go back and look through every single game to find, like, how do you find a stat like that?
So True Media, we work with Opta to develop a soccer tool. And within that web-based tool, you can query. So, you know, it's basically find me games in which a player had a red card and a missed penalty. So not terribly difficult. I had to, you know, manipulate data a little bit. But most of the stuff, the tool makes it easy for teams or media, whoever it is, to, you know, find what you're looking for at a game level. So it's a lot to sift through, and it might take a couple minutes. But something like that, it's really just you get the idea in your head and then figure out exactly how to do it on the site.
So what are some of, as you've kind of gone along, you said, I think it's really fascinating that you got this huge dump of data for the World Cup that mm-hmm. you guys weren't maybe even, it was too difficult to even sift through. As you've kind of grown on, it's been 8 to 10 years since then. What are some of your favorite stats when describing soccer games that people might not use all the time?
Right. I think you're all, if you're a soccer fan, you're familiar with the concept of expected goals. Mm-hmm. I mean, I like it just in that it gives you kind of that next step of how good the shots were. I think it's useful. And even as kind of a similar but simpler version of that, something I've been looking at a lot lately is like the percentage of shots you take inside the box, which is basically a proxy for shot quality. And in the last 10 years in pretty much every league, teams are taking a higher and higher percentage of shots inside the box, moving from, you know, I think MLS, I want to say, was roughly like 53%. Now it's around closer to over 60%, which is interesting to me. I mean, it means that, you know, whether coaches are and players are using these numbers or not, the principals are getting through, and they're taking better shots on the whole, which obviously gives you a better chance of scoring. So, I mean, that's just kind of one example of something like that. And when you're talking World Cup's almost a different animal, because you can find, you know, whenever anyone's the first guy since Pelé to do something like Mbappe was the youngest in a World Cup final. Like, those are always great. It's kind of a different, almost a different level when you're pulling out legends and you can compare on this global stage like that. So there's kind of that whole range of different things, whether it's a historical something, which is a great note, whether you get really in the weeds with expected goals and things like that as well. I really enjoy both sides of that.
You retweeted a number that I thought was really interesting earlier today, actually, which chronicled the number of MLS passes per team per game going back from 2013 to now. And basically, there's been a steady increase that we're seeing more passes per team per game. What does that tell you about the league, if anything?
I mean, I think it's just the growth of the league, and I think Sporting KC is a pretty good microcosm of this. You know, if you look at the way Sporting KC played 5 years ago, 10 years ago, even under Vermes, like it was different. It was a little more direct. It was a little more counterattacking. Not nearly as much possession. And in the last, especially in the last 2, 3, 4 years, it's really transitioned into much more of a possession base and kind of proactive rather than reactive style of offense. And I think what Sporting KC has done is a little bit reflective of the league on the whole. You know, every team's trying to have a little bit more of the ball and do a little bit more with it offensively and just take that extra time, and that adds up to, you know, what is it, 20 more passes a game per team or so over the last 10 years. So I think Sporting KC and the league are kind of on parallel paths in that sense.
Does it – I mean, my initial reaction is that it has to mean more quality, that there's maybe less of those series where the ball's just being volleyed back and forth, you know, aimlessly in the middle of the field, that the teams actually kind of have an idea. Is that too simplified, or is that accurate in your mind?
No, I think that's basically it. Yeah, you got a plan. You're not sending a searching ball or whatever it might be, trying to, you know, hope something happens, as much as you're just being patient. So I think it's a matter of more of a plan. Coaches are better, I think, on the whole than they were, you know, 10, 20 years ago in the league, which is part of it too. And players are better, and there's also more of a, you know, more of a Latin influence. I think that's part of it too. It's kind of a possession style that you see a little more in those countries, and there's been more and more of that, especially kind of your midfield playmaker. You see that a lot more prevalent than maybe it used to be. So, yeah, all those things kind of go in the same way.
All right, Paul, so I have a kind of random off-the-wall question, but in this Sporting's Champions League run here, it's been tough to talk about it's been tough to talk about the MLS performance in this competition without – having to delineate before it was called Champions League. It used to be the Cup. Where do you land on, you know, this is Sporting's first semifinal in the Champions League, but maybe not in this competition. What do you think on, you know, where's the markers there?
So the way I and a few others have kind of fallen on this is basically treating it the same way as Europe does. So In Europe, the Champions League era officially began in 92, but the European Cup stretches all the way back to 1955.
Yeah.
And so for that purposes and for CONCACAF, I'll use Champions League to refer to the Champions League era. So in CONCACAF, I think it's since 2008. And I'll use CONCACAF Cup to refer all the way back to, I forget what year it started, but to encompass those, you know, 1996 to 2008 years from an MLS standpoint. So, you know, CONCACAF Cup, just like a generic catch-all that can cover, you know, the pre and post 2008 and Champions League since 2008, because there are some differences in format. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it's still the CONCACAF club tournament of record. So I think you can use both eras in different ways, depending on kind of what you're trying to do with it. But it's good to have ways to cover both with slightly different jargon, if you will.
I love that question because it is like when we try to refer to it on the broadcast, we're saying, hey, first time in the semifinals in franchise history. But
they actually, as you tweeted out, they were in a semifinal back in.
Right. They meant. Yeah, just different. As long as you get the wording right, you know, I don't have a problem with either one. They're just kind of telling different stories.
So let me ask you if there's a stat for this. We're trying to put into context what type of a mountain to climb Sporting Kansas City have in front of them with three big Mexican powerhouses up next, and maybe most specifically Monterrey. A lot of people like to look at budgets. Is there any statistic, whether it's just salary structure or history or anything like that, that in your mind really illustrates like what Sporting Kansas City is up against in this round?
Yeah, I mean, the budget is definitely one thing. You know, the numbers are hard to come by from a Mexico standpoint. You know, there's websites like Transfer Market that kind of value players in the transfer. That's kind of a market. It's all theoretical, but mm-hmm. sometimes that can give you something interesting. The historical thing is real. I mean, and it's not just the fact that it's Monterrey, which has won, you know, I think they won 3 CCL titles just in this era. And they've won, you know, I forget how many Mexican League titles and things like that. Yeah. And it's just, it's Mexico too. You know, I mean, they've won, you know, every one of these titles, I think off the top of my head, I think it's since the Galaxy in 02 or something, or 2000, something like that. So you're fighting, you know, one of the best teams in the best league in the continent. And they're an accomplished bunch as well. And it's not just a generic Mexican team. It's Monterrey, which is one of their big 4 clubs down there. So, I mean, almost any way you slice it, KC is up against it. And they've also, you know, proven that, you know, they can hang with them. I mean, they destroyed Toluca, which is having a down year, but is traditionally a really good club. And, you know, it's a 2-game series. You're getting one at home. And you're never, they're not a giant underdog. They're an underdog, but, you know, this is not an impossible mountain to climb, but it is a mountain to climb.
All right, so once again, we're visiting with Paul Carr. Before we let you go, Paul, you also, you know, obviously you've told us that you've covered the national team scene and all that. I've seen your activity on Twitter getting into the Greg Berhalter, you know, I don't know if we want to call it a controversial decision to go with Tyler Adams at right back. I have some thoughts on it, but what are yours? What do you think, first of all, on Berhalter and on this decision with Tyler Adams?
I have mixed feelings about this because, you know, one of the things Klinsmann got destroyed for, and mostly justifiably in my mind, is playing players, we'll say, out of position. And so it strikes me as strange that you take a kid like Tyler Adams, who's been really good at kind of a defensive midfield spot with RB Leipzig, one of the better teams in Germany, and moving him out of position. Having said that, the flip side is that Berhalter has a plan. You know, and Klinsmann, it seemed like he was just trying players willy-nilly and didn't really know what he was doing. We've seen Berhalter's system already in a couple friendlies as this with his right-back central midfielder hybrid. And it almost seemed like it was designed for the Red. So, well, it seems strange to take a player out of a system or out of a position that he's been playing. The fact that there's a plan and there's intent, and this is not like a fly-by-night idea that you just woke up with and decided to go with, makes me... I'll give Berhalter the benefit of the doubt at this point and see how it works out on the field. And if it doesn't work and he sticks with it, then I think we got issues. But if he's willing to adapt it after it doesn't work, then we'll see that we seem to have a good, smart coach.
Well, and I guess if you're going to tinker with things, the friendlies are the time to do it,
right,
as opposed to when you're, say, playing Mexico in Columbus.
Right.
Trying to qualify for the World Cup, right?
Exactly. Yeah, we'll throw out this defensive formation we barely ever use. Yeah, it'll be fine against Mexico. Don't worry about it.
Well, hey, Paul, this is great stuff, man. We really appreciate it. Again, I'll tell everybody, if you're looking for some good insight, specifically on the statistical side of things, check out Paul Carr's Twitter feed, at Paul Carr, C-A-R-R, and hopefully we can talk to you again sometime soon. Welcome back to Kansas, man.
Thank you. I'll see you guys out at Sporting KC games this year.
There you go. That's Paul Carr. He lives in Topeka, Kansas, born and raised, and breaking down stats for people all over the world, apparently. Pretty good stuff. And that's going to do it for us, Carter, on this edition of the Sporting Kansas City Show. You got big plans this weekend? I mean, you got the Swope
Rangers,
Park Rangers man. Game.
Swope Park Rangers, yeah. That's it. Fully focused.
Give it another plug. Where you know, people can come out and watch the game.
4 p.m. at Children's Mercy Park. Get on out there.
Let's go. Should be good weather this weekend as well. So, all right, that's going to do it for us. For Taylor Twellman, for Paul Carr, for Carter Augustine, this is Nate Bucchetti saying thanks for listening again to the Sporting Kansas City Show.